Hello, the recursive community. My name is Elena, and I am the country lead in Romania at the Recursive. Today, I'm going to be your host, and I have the pleasure of picking the brain of a woman in tech about the future of education. Lavinia Mehedințu has dipped her toes in different educational programs as a student before embarking on her entrepreneurial journey of her own in the learning and developing pool with the social learning platform Offbeat. With a diverse background in HR and communication, Lavinia aims to provide a fresh and actionable twist to the learning industry's ongoing transformation. Hello, Lavinia, and thank you for joining the podcast today. I definitely look forward to dive deeper into your learning perspective.
Hi, thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to the conversation as well.
Well, then we are ready to dive in. Can you share with us your first memory from school? Was it a topic or a professor that empowered you to learn something or maybe put you off from learning something? Mm-hmm.
I actually have two stories here, one positive, one negative. But my first memory is from sixth grade. I had a really good history teacher. She was super passionate about the field. And I remember she asked some of us if we would like to join a competition. We had no idea what it was about, but we knew we were going to work in teams. And, you know, sixth grade, that was fun. And we ended up joining the competition to build a miniature layout of a concentration camp from the Holocaust, because in sixth grade you learn about the Second World War and the terrors of the Holocaust. And it was really interesting because it was very different to how we were learning in school. You know, we wouldn't sit in a chair and listen to a teacher mm-hmm. and maybe ask some questions, but rather we had something very practical to do. And then together with my colleague, we would just run and learn as much as we could, read, look at pictures, and also share with each other what we were learning. And it was obviously a very emotional journey as well, learning about all those things. So yeah, very, very different, you know, and I think, again, the passion of the teacher combined with the this new setup, and it was very exciting for us. To be honest, I don't even know if we won the competition or not, but it's still one of my best memories. And then I came to Bucharest to study literature and languages, Romanian and French. And I remember I was in a seminar and we were talking about some critic, and I raised my hand and asked a question that maybe was a bit edgy, maybe a bit challenging. And I remember my teacher telling me that I should just sit down and keep my questions for myself. And I think it was such an important moment for me because in the following weeks, I decided to drop university, which shaped everything moving forward.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to find out that, well, the journey is definitely more important and how not exactly where you land, but the journey is it. And talking about journeys, we look forward to diving into yours. Mm-hmm. So what inspired now? Take us further to developing Offbeat and tell us what it is exactly.
Well, I think I always had this desire to do something, to take something from, you know, zero to hero, because my parents were like that. They are not entrepreneurs, but they built our house on their own. You know, they had to learn so much, you know, the plumbing, the electricity, and they inspired me in that way. But I didn't know exactly what am I supposed to do? What problem should I solve? And I always say that I didn't actually start it Offbeat, but Offbeat picked me because it all started during the first weekend of the pandemic. We were in lockdown and I was bored, very bored. And I posted a couple of learning and development resources on LinkedIn. And I really liked the conversation that post sparked. So I kept on going until someone said, okay, why don't you turn this into a newsletter? And I turned it into a newsletter. And the newsletter opened so many doors for me. I got to meet so many people. I think by now I've talked to more than 200 people. And it was just amazing. And it allowed me to discover that L&D professionals from all corners of the world have similar challenges. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I'm always the one to introduce people to each other. And that's how the community started, because I wanted a space for people to, you know, social learning, to learn from each other. There's so much knowledge in the industry, and there's so much need to move forward with the industry. So that's how Offbeat started, and it's just this platform for learning and development professionals and people professionals to learn and also forward their careers, because we are, everyone in people knows that we are so busy with helping others in learning, but we sometimes we're like the shoemakers without shoes.
As a follow-up to what you said there, where your community is based in different countries, mm-hmm. are they more from a specific country?
Yeah, I think so. Romania is definitely a big hub just mm-hmm. because I'm from here, but US is also a big hub, UK. Mm-hmm. We have some people in Australia, in South America, Germany and Netherlands. I guess, you know, the countries where there's also a more progressive view of how people should be treated in organizations, and they are interested in learning more modern practices.
That's interesting to have the opportunity to tap into their experience and learn and bring it locally, regionally to yours. Yeah, I actually read some of the blog posts that you posted on Offbeat, and you mentioned there's something that stuck with me, that you have an innate desire to solve a problem mm-hmm. at the same time as a need for freedom. How do you balance these two seemingly opposite desires in your entrepreneurial path?
Well, it's interesting because I don't see them as opposite necessarily, because for me, the need for freedom, it's the need for autonomy. You know, I have the resources to build something, but I can do it however I want or however I discover it's best to do it, you know, without constraints, without the we have to do it in a certain way. Like I grew up with we have to mm-hmm. and I don't really like it. And I was also very fortunate in my career to be part of organizations where we have to wasn't said. We were just okay, we look at data, we make the best decisions that we can based on that data, you know. So that for me is autonomy. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, solving a problem, you know, I have the autonomy to pick the problem that I'm passionate about, that I can solve, and then I can focus for myself as, you know, the skills and knowledge that people and L&D professionals might lack. But then how I solve that problem, it's up to me and the community, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's how I try to balance it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I want to tap a little bit into the personal side with this follow-up to what you said. You mentioned we all have memories that are maybe not optimistic or happy, mm-hmm. but how do you see them now? Do you see them as like have to? Mm-hmm. The situations when you had to do something. Do you see them now as that was such a great opportunity for me to evolve? Mm-hmm. Or do you feel them, they're still like carrying you, they're pressing on your shoulders, you still carry them with you in a way? How do you see them? As a challenge, an opportunity?
Yeah, I think you still carry them, especially if you heard them so many times. And I was lucky enough not to hear them from my parents, but rather from society in general. You carry them, but on the other hand, if you surround yourself with the people that are courageous, where you have to, it mm-hmm. doesn't matter. I think it also pushes you to go beyond what you have to do. You know, you have to go to school, to university and get a degree. I didn't do that. And I'm lucky that I was courageous enough not to pursue that traditional path, because it led me to where I am now. Again, it's still there, you know, there's the mindset that those words are still in my head, but I'm trying to be aware of them. I think that's super important, being aware of the barriers that you had and just try to go beyond them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Before embarking on your entrepreneurial journey, you had previous experience in the corporate world for mm-hmm. over 5 years, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. How do you believe that experience shaped your career now?
Oh, I talk with so much joy about that time of my life. I was so lucky to be a part of a Romanian company. I was part of an EMAG for I think more than 6 years. And I joined them when they were, I think, about 1,500 employees. And I left when there were more than 7,000 employees. And I was so lucky to be a part of that growth journey because it allowed me to see firsthand how decisions were made, why they were made as they were, especially being a Romanian company. This was the hub. This was where decisions were made. And, you know, you can say that, but if you don't have the visibility, if the board is not very open to sharing all that process with employees, you're still not getting enough. But I was lucky that the board was, it was especially in the beginning, they were so open to, you know, we have these goals, but why do we have these goals? We have to focus on the customer, but why do we have to focus on the customer? And yeah, I'm still, to be honest, very inspired by Iulian Stanciu, the former CEO of eMAG. I basically grew up watching him mm-hmm. and the way he led the business. And I think that's where my passion for business was nurtured. Again, having that visibility and seeing how other people were passionate. And then the way they looked at data, the way they treated a customer, or just everything shaped the way I'm doing business at Offbeat mm-hmm. right now. So yeah, and also because we were talking about autonomy, I think we had the autonomy of experimenting, which was so important, you know, for me staying as much as I did, but also it came with responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I think that built a discipline in me that you need as a founder. So I'm extremely thankful for being a part of the company.
It's very interesting that you mentioned the snowball effect in a way of, mm-hmm. of a corporate, and also the first mentor in a way in your career now, because mm-hmm. Offbeat is, I understand that it's based on a membership, on mm-hmm. mentorship. Mm-hmm. You have been, what have been the most successful strategies developing Offbeat? Mm-hmm. Maybe that you got inspired. You started mm-hmm. to saying that this inspired you, the previous collaboration. What are some strategies that you actually used on point on growing mm-hmm. Offbeat?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing that we did was stay pre-revenue a lot. And if I would go back now, I would stay pre-revenue even more, because that allowed us to provide value to the customer, but also get to know them as well as possible before shaping a solution, you know. So mm-hmm. just staying pre-revenue, meeting, again, all sorts of people from all corners of the world and getting to know their challenges, the solutions they currently employ to learn themselves and the feedback they have for those solutions. That was, I think, also the best part. It came with not so much pressure as we are now. So that was definitely a very good strategy for us. And then, again, looking at data, you know, you do all your research, but what I also learned from eMAG is how you look at that research, how you're trying to get insights to make sure you're making the best decisions possible for shaping the product that you're building, tech or not tech. It doesn't always have to be tech. So those two things, and constantly talking, even now, where we have a community of more than 100 people, we are always trying to co-create the solution. So mm-hmm. we're always asking, okay, how do you feel about this? Are your challenges still the same? How you will build this and so on. So just continuing that conversation, even when your product is out there, I feel it's so important.
Can you tell me how big is the community?
So we're over 100 people mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah. From various
paying background. Customers.
Yeah. Paying customers, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I see you're very active on social media, especially mm-hmm. LinkedIn. So mm-hmm. I do have to find out more about how do you feel social media supported the growth of the project, and what inspires you to post on different platforms, on the website, on LinkedIn?
Mm-hmm. Well, we started on LinkedIn, you know, it all started with that post I made on LinkedIn. And I think it allowed us to go global. right? Because if I would have just joined events and so on, I would have stayed local. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from across our borders. So I think we keep on doing that because we are having conversations with people from all over the world, and we are sparking very interesting conversations. So I'm learning a lot by being there. I'm learning a lot about my customers as well, you know. And we picked the time of posting, how much we post, the content that we're posting by looking at data as well. What worked before, we're gonna try to reiterate and do more of that. Now, we haven't nailed yet other platforms where we should be very present because our audience is there, but we're gonna try and do that and see how much of what we're already doing, the content that we already have, we can redeploy on other platforms with the same success, hopefully. Yeah.
You mentioned an audience. Can you give me a little description of the persona? Who are you targeting
so nice.
In a way?
Yeah. So we are targeting learning and development or people professionals that have around 5 years of experience. And so far, they usually work in, you know, companies with less than 1,500 employees because they have more autonomy in what practices they can employ. From all over the world that have, I said this once to one of my advisors, and she was so excited to hear that they have an itch. Mm-hmm. They have an itch to do things differently. They know that the traditional ways we have used so far are no longer a match to the working environment we are living in now. So yeah, briefly, that's my my audience.
Thank you. So Offbeat's goal is to support L&D professionals, accelerate their career growth through practice and knowledge sharing. In your opinion, what is the most effective way to facilitate learning and knowledge sharing in today's fast-paced world, and especially when adding AI to the equation?
That's such a good question. And I think we need a podcast to talk only about that. I think in my experience so far, I found three practices that were extremely helpful and based, I think that's why they were helpful. They were based on science, on research. They are social learning, because you mentioned knowledge sharing, just learning from each other. Then practice, you mentioned that as well. You know, we learn a lot by doing as adults. I think 90% of the time we learn because we have a problem that we need to solve. We might not know how to solve it, so we jump on learning something new. And then reflection. Because, you know, otherwise our bodies would only leave, but our brains need to be there as well and to absorb everything that we're learning. I always say that we already hold so much knowledge, but because we don't stop and think about what we learned from our previous projects or from, you know, different people that we've met, we just don't get to use that knowledge. So these three practices, I think they should be used by any organization. And I think what's important though is that organizations need to be able to, you know, facilitate that psychological safety as well. Because if you don't feel safe in an environment, it's less likely that you will experiment, that you will share what you're learning with others, because, you know, you might be afraid of being judged, you might be afraid of being punished for a mistake you've done, you know. So I think the basis of all these very healthy practices, in my opinion, it's still psychological safety. And because you mentioned AI, what I was saying earlier is that as adults, we learn very problem-focused. And I think AI can help us with that. You know, it can bring us some very personalized learning experience. I have a problem, I go into, I don't know, GPT-4 or whatever else everyone uses, and ask the question, and I get an answer for my question, which is amazing. But on the other hand, I think my previous manager had this saying, garbage in, garbage out. So to get an effective answer to our questions, the question should also be very good. So that's why I think in the coming 3 months ago, I would have said years, but now I'm saying just in the coming months, probably, we'll need to get better at prompting. That's going to be a skill that everyone, not only engineers, but everyone who uses this technology needs to be very good at, as long as they want to get the best results out of whatever tool they use.
Do you see AI, so you see AI more as a bouncing off ideas with team member in a way, as AI will become a team member some in a certain way, bouncing off ideas rather than a mentorship teaching you something?
I think it can be both. Yeah. It can be even, you know, I read research papers, for example, and it takes me such a long while because there are so many terms that I don't understand. But now I'm just going into GPT-4 and, you know, copy-paste that phrase or just the word, and I get the explanation of what's behind that word. So it can be a brainstorming pal. It can be a mentor. It can be, you know, it can give you ideas just if you ask it. So there's a lot that it can be as long as we know how to use it. And I still feel people underestimate how good the questions have to be to for you to get the good answer.
Thank you. I want to tap into the mentorship component of your project. What qualities do you look in a mentor, and how do you match mentors with mentees?
Well, because we're so much about social learning, we first time we thought about this, what we knew is that we need high quality mentors, you know, but it took us a while to understand what high quality mentors are. The first thought I think we had was expertise. Then we thought, yeah, but people with less years of experience might have a lot of experience. So we wouldn't want to just look at, you know, someone that has over 3 years of experience. And it was interesting because we learned from our mentors, from our successful mentors, what a successful profile looks like. And I think there are two things that are super important. The first one is flexibility and the ability to adapt. Because when we look at our mentors, they are not only about knowledge sharing. They have to tap into different personas, I would like to say. They have to ask questions. They need to be good at asking questions and holding that coaching space, maybe. They might need to be open to facilitate different introductions or opportunities for their mentees. So I think that adaptability and flexibility plays a big role into a mentor being successful. And the second one is the openness to learn, because in our view, it doesn't matter how experienced you are. You're never gonna stop learning. And we hear that so much from our mentors. I'm learning so much, either through the process, because I have to take a step back, reflect, think about what I learned and my projects, or from the other person, from my mentee, from their experiences. So I think these two are so, so important. And to answer your second question, I think there are different things we take into account when matching. The first thing we didn't want to do is just throw our mentors pool, because we do have a mentors pool that's just waiting to get matched. We didn't want to throw, you know, 40 people at a mentee and just let them choose, because, you know, it's information overload. It's so hard to choose. So we get to know all our community members. When they join, we have conversations with them, and we try and understand their challenges, who they are, where they're coming from. And with that knowledge, we curate for them 3 to 5 profiles of people that we really think could help them, either because they've been where the mentees are, because they are coming from similar industries, from similar company sizes, because those things can play an important role as well, or because we can see there are similarities in how they approach their learning and their work. So, yeah, company profile, it's important. The personalities of people, are important. But the challenges are extremely important as well.
How do you do this? How do you do the matching? Is it you?
It's manual.
It's manual.
It's still manual. I think I'm still finding it hard to let go of control and employ some sort of technology, but it's still very manual. We still meet all our members. We're still early stage, so I think it's important to do the things that don't scale, to learn how technology could be applied and still keeping that high quality relationship with both the community member and the mentor.
Mm-hmm. Do you also use it? Do you work? Are you paired with a mentor through Off, or you're just building it?
I'm not paired with a mentor through Offbeat, but actually a former guest of yours, Senia Montan, is my mm-hmm. mentor. So
That's amazing.
I do have a mentor.
Yes, women in tech. It's interesting. I have to ask now. Why her?
I think it was just she was close to me. We are good friends, and I knew her. I knew how that we could resonate. You know, it's interesting because in the startup world, you hear a lot about scaling fast, growing fast, spending money, and she's not like that. She's very wise in the way that she grows, and I really appreciated that about her. That's just one example. And yeah, we could resonate, so we have a bunch of meetings now where I can learn a lot from her.
That's amazing to have somebody in the ecosystem in a way, and it's also female.
Yes.
I have to say this, female power. What is the role of social learning and behavior change in personal and professional growth? I definitely want to tap into the personal as well, because it's valuable for the business side. And how can we create environments to promote these processes, to promote a balance?
I'm going to start with behavior change, because I still feel, even in our industry where we deal with learning and behavior change, there are still some, you know, traditional things we're using that are not based in science. One thing that we're not aware of is how hard behavior change is. There are so many stars that need to align for someone to change their behavior. And you know, we jump into providing these patches, these pills to such a complex issue. We usually employ training, you know, a one-day training for someone to learn how to share feedback, which is so personal and so hard. And I feel there's a need for people to be more aware of how our brain works and how we learn. So something that I advise and everyone in the community is trying to do is to teach others how to learn and teach others how, you know, our neurons connect and how hard it is to change behaviors, so that we can jump from these one-time learning events into a more comprehensive, a long-term learning strategy. And that's where I think social learning comes into play as well, because, you know, instead of only being listening to someone that's more experienced than you in training or workshops and so on, we usually learn, we copy, we mirror what others around us are doing. And it's not only about the technical part of things, but it's also about the soft, although it's so wrong to say soft, the, you know, confidence, getting the confidence to try out those things. It's not that easy. But when you are surrounded by others that are doing the same and that are supporting you, you're going to have more confidence in doing it. So, yeah, I think social learning, it's just a tool, a very good tool to facilitate that behavior change. And another part of your question was, how can we facilitate that? And I'm going back to one of my previous answers. I think psychological safety plays a big, big role. We really need, you know, leaders of companies, and I'm seeing this now, leaders of companies need to be open to admitting that, you know, they are making mistakes as well, that they are learning tremendously from those mistakes, and that their organization can do the same, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy. It's a very, especially I think in Southeastern Europe, more than in other places, it's hard to create that psychological safety. It means letting go of ego, letting go of power. So yeah, I think psychological safety is very important.
Yeah, it's true. Our area, the region, not only our country, is known for its armor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In a way, we lift it up in a way.
Yes, it is.
Connected to your answer, how does remote hybrid work? Because for social and mimetism to learn, mm-hmm. you have mm-hmm. to actually see.
Yes, I think it has to be more intentional, and maybe that's where L&D can play a role and leaders play a role, but it still happens. Like, we have so many companies that have only operated remotely and are still successful, and not only being successful business-wise, but they've managed to create these organizations where, you know, learning happens, mm-hmm. but it does have to be more intentional. You have to be aware of how you can share knowledge, you know, in meetings, in one-on-one conversations, asynchronously as well. If you think about it, even our community is remote first, mm-hmm. but we're still learning from each other because we have that intention of, okay, we look closely at where people meet and how they can, yeah, create those spaces for reflection and asking questions and sharing their knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. You still repeat a word and it's like my ears, you know, it's like it's there. You have to ask successful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does this mean to you? It's such a cliche, and I usually step far away from cliches, but I have to ask.
Oh, that's such a hard question.
It is.
I think the definition changes over mm-hmm. time, to be honest. If I, when I was younger, I would have probably said, you know, building a big business where people are happy. And yeah, I think right now is having impact. I think that matters a lot, especially in mm-hmm. our space where mm-hmm. so much about learning and helping others grow. I think, yeah, just seeing that our clients are moving the needle for themselves and for their organizations. Whenever I talk to a client and they're saying, I got promoted and I think Offbit had such a big role to play in me being able to get this promotion, I'm like, okay, I'm doing this for something. There's, yeah, I have an impact. I think that that's very important.
Mm-hmm. How big is the Offbit team? I know about the community, but how big is the team?
We're two people. Mm-hmm. We're two people, and we have a lot of help from our advisors, because we do have a board of advisors, mm-hmm. and from our mentors as well, just that, like I was mentioning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. I want to go back a little bit towards data in a way, but not specific. How can we measure the impact of learning and development programs? So think of, like, your target are B2B companies, right?
Yes, yes.
And what metrics should they use, company mm-hmm. managers, to determine the effectiveness mm-hmm. of these type of programs?
That's such a good question. Such a good one. And it's so discussed in our community because it's so, so hard to mm-hmm. measure behavior change and skill yeah. acquisition. But my first thought would be to go beyond what we're doing right now. And everyone who's in the community and is listening to this, they know what I mean. Right now, what we're doing is that we're measuring NPS, for example, after a training or a workshop. We're measuring attendance rates, how many people joined a training session, or how many people finished an e-learning. And I call these vanity metrics. They aren't telling you if you've made an impact. They might tell you that people are happy, which I'm not saying it can be important for the behavior change to happen, but we shouldn't just stay at that level. Mm-hmm. And what we've been talking about a lot in the community is that first you need to understand the problem very well. What are you trying to do with the learning solution you're employing? First, understand the problem. Then, of course, brainstorm different solutions. You know, training is not always the best way to do things. And then we can borrow something from other disciplines. For example, A/B testing from UX design or marketing, or randomized control tests from scientific research. What that means is basically that you have, let's say, 100 people that you want to impact. You're going to split that audience into two. You're going to leave one part of the audience, group A, for example, untouched. You're just going to do their jobs. We're not going to do anything for them. And audience B will be, you know, attending a learning program or whatever learning solution you choose. Once you do that, you're going to see if your learning solution was impactful in any way. Mm-hmm. And it's easier to say, okay, this is what actually impacted their performance, for example, you know. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't do, what usually happens is that we don't have the time to do the A/B testing. So we take the 100 people and just throw the learning solution at them. And then we sit back and we think, okay, it seems that a change is happening, but why? We have no idea. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's easier to just say, oh, this learning solution is what happened, before scaling to everyone. So I think this process of understanding the problem, brainstorming different solutions, A/B testing and measurement is what everyone should do. And because you asked about metrics as well, I think I always refer back to the two things we want to impact: people and the business as well. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to people, you can look at engagement, you can look at retention, career progression, at what else, just how much they stay with the company and so on. But when it comes to business, you're looking at revenue, you're looking at cost efficiency, you're looking, what else, just how the way people collaborate in the organization impacts the business and so on. So yeah, the people, always think of the people and the business side alike.
Thank you. What I understand is that even when offering your team the freedom to learn and develop, mm-hmm. you still need to be a little bit more hands-on, so you mm-hmm. can all grow individually but in the same direction. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of companies offering perks like 500, 1,000 euros per year, mm-hmm. and they give them a dashboard with all the options, all the companies and all the mental health apps, learning development mm-hmm. apps, fitness apps. But there's no common strategy. Mm-hmm. You should mm-hmm. choose one for your mental health. You should mm-hmm. choose one for learning and development. Mm-hmm. You should choose one for fitness.
Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying, I completely agree with. And there are two dimensions here. First, how aware am I of what I need to learn to become better? Mm-hmm. And how aware am I of what the company needs for me to learn, you know? Mm-hmm. And just throwing money at people, in my opinion, it's not the best way of doing things, because we are in an era of information overload, right? So it's really hard to choose. And we've seen many companies having those learning stipends that you mm-hmm. mentioned that just are not used.
No.
Because people don't know what to choose. So, you know, companies giving clarity about where we are heading and what our skills and our competencies need to be, what we need to learn, and then matching that vision with my personal strategy as an individual, mm-hmm. what I would like to learn and where I feel I can perform best, raising that awareness for people, I think that's the best way to do things.
If you can say no to me, but I'm curious, what would your elevator pitch be to a company to get off the hamster wheel of their moving forward, we're scaling and we're growing, we don't have time to take the time to do the A/B testing. What would the elevator pitch be? You can get as creative as you want, you can go wild, and you can say, no, I won't do it, I don't have the brain power for that.
I think it's you're losing 90% of the budget you are deploying, you're investing into those initiatives if you don't do these things.
True. It's yeah. like, give me the sack of money and I'll burn it for you, yeah. because that's what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. That's a better one, actually.
We are going through an economic turmoil after the health pandemic, and the job market is impactful. Mm-hmm. We all see the news is like sharing a lot of data about career changes in a way, yes. and career decision. What opportunities do you feel that could arise from these changes?
I think 20 years ago, if I would look at my parents, they joined a role, they maybe progressed, but in the same, on the same path, you know, the same role, the same department, maybe sticking with the same company for 20, 30 years, if no, not more. And I think we won't be able to do that. I think that's the big change that's happening. I think I read somewhere that in our lifetime, we might switch 8 companies, departments, roles. If I join HR 10 years from now, I might not be in HR, which is such a great opportunity, just viewing, broadening your horizons, seeing how product works, marketing, HR, just combining all these skills. I think that's a really nice opportunity, especially for a generation that's maybe can stay settled. Their attention span is very low and our attention span is very low. So I think that's the biggest opportunity for us to, and even in during this time where you have to reconsider what your career will look like, I think it's an opportunity. It's awful to what's happening when people are laid off. I've spoken to people that have been in that position, but they are also saying, I'm just taking a break from all that, you know, hamster wheel, and just thinking of where I would like to go next. And I think big changes will come in people's lives from that reflection moment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have a friend who's in HR, and she used to think of a person through her or his CV. Mm-hmm. And when she saw people jumping, job hopping from position to position, like 10 years ago, she kept jumping between these. I don't know, it's jumping. Mm-hmm. But now the shift has changed. Of course, she's targeting Gen Zs. Mm-hmm. And Gen Zs, they're different. If they don't feel they evolve in the company, they leave because it's not on their path. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely cool to be in HR today because it's different. It has changed. It keeps you on your toes. Mm-hmm. It keeps you evolving.
Mm-hmm. I think we have more, more squiggly careers, you know. So instead of a ladder, you have people just jumping from department to department, and organizations need to be aware of that, and they need to facilitate those career transitions, which is not easy but definitely effective.
I love the squiggly career thing. It's a meme of today's interview. I'm getting closer, and we have talked about development, but I also want to tap a little bit into anxiety, mental health. How can these challenges that we most of us have some in some level can impact the success of an entrepreneurial path. Mm-hmm. It can be an entrepreneurial, it can be a professional path, let's call it. So we don't limit it to entrepreneurial. Mm-hmm. What strategies can be used to overcome this setbacks in the company, in your personal, professional life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when I started my career, I thought the hardest to gain are the technical skills. And then as I progressed, even in my previous company or with Offbit right now, I learned that actually my mental health is the most important one and the one that can stay in the way of me learning and progressing. But what I also learned, and I'm lucky enough to have a support system. Either, you know, my parents are there for me, are very supportive. My partner is very supportive. My friends are very supportive. So just because you're gonna face, especially as an entrepreneur, you're gonna face so many challenges and you're gonna ask yourself, why am I doing this? Why am I struggling? Why, whatever. And just going back to your support system that's steady and, you know, you feel like your feet is back on the ground. Because otherwise, everything, like the uncertainty you have to live with, it's really, really hard to grasp. But yeah, I think a strategy is just to build your support system, to make sure that people around you are supportive, they understand, to be, for you to be open, to say it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's not as easy as it seems from the outside, especially with, I'm talking now about startups, or 3 years ago, you would only see the success stories. And looking at yourself and how much you're struggling, you would wonder, like, why is this so hard for me when others seem to have nailed it? I feel now we're more open, but they never told the story of the beginnings of Facebook, of Airbnb, of all these big companies, where founders struggled a lot as well, especially with their mental health. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, just being open and having that support system, I think, is really important.
If you allow me, can I dive a little deeper into a pinpoint situation that supported you, a challenge? Mm-hmm. You can choose whatever you want, and how the support system helped you with that particular challenge. Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I think when I decided to quit, for example, it was, I didn't know what I was throwing myself at. I had no idea what I was about to encounter in my journey. And my parents, who are, you know, they come from a traditional path. They haven't seen this and lived with, or they lived with uncertainty, but for them, it was important to keep steady, to have your financial safety and everything else. They could have gone, why are you doing this? It's not good. You're not gonna succeed, and so on. And they did nothing like that. They were just like, it's your call. We're going to be here no matter what. If you're succeeding, if you're failing, we're going to be here. And yeah, I think that was the best thing that happened at that early stage, to have the support of my parents, to know they are there. Like, obviously my partner, my friends as well, but my parents, yeah, they were the most important to convince that this is okay to do for me.
They knew it's in the DNA.
yeah, exactly.
That there, that you have a resilience core there, that you can do it even on your own. Yeah. And you learn enough and they're giving you wings. It's impressive.
Yeah.
My final question, I have to find out, where are these wings growing in the future? Where are you taking Offbit?
Oh, I think growth is obviously on our radar. But as I was saying earlier, something that Senia and others have inspired me as well, it's sustainable growth. Mm-hmm. So we are not planning, growing exponentially. That's one thing. Then growing more awareness about the problem we're trying to solve and the solution that we're employing, and just becoming a trusted partner, because we do have competitors. They are more traditional, but they are there. Mm-hmm. So it's important for us to have the trust of the people. And to have the trust of the people, we've built this board of advisors that are really cool, that are just very well-known people in our industries. And yeah, just using also our community to spread the word about Offbeat. So more awareness and more growth, more sustainable growth, though, is definitely on our path.
Thank you. And before I go in and have another one, I can't stop. No, I'm kidding. What's one piece of recommendation? It's not advice. It's something, a thought that you would share with startup founders from our region.
From our region.
I niched it.
Yeah. I think it's be aware of the limiting beliefs that you have acquired growing up. Mm-hmm. Because if you go outside of Southeastern Europe, you will be surprised by how confident people are, how well they can market themselves, and so on. And I still feel we do have that. We're small, So yeah, just be aware of those limiting beliefs and try to go beyond them.
Thank you so much for joining us today and for imparting such valuable insights to go bold or go home. That's what we're going to do. Thank you so much, the Recursive community, for watching us, and stay tuned for the next episode.
Next on the Recursive podcast, Yunus Vlad, the co-founder of Tokinomo.
We heard that a good way to start a startup would be to go to an accelerator. Mm-hmm. So we applied for some, and we were accepted by a US-based accelerator. So we went, me and my co-founder Lawrence, in the United States for like 4 months. It was a crazy journey. completely wrong state, I would say now, but still we've learned there the ABC of founding a startup. And this actually, that was the moment when we quit our jobs, because we were working up until then. So, and we didn't know anything, like equity, funding, vesting, what is that? I need to have all the shares right now. What are you talking about, vesting? What's that?
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere.